fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, and no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Boy, we've got a really fine guest tonight, Ray McGovern. He's been a CIA official, an officer, and he's turned a political activist, and thank goodness he has, because he's really helping this nation now. He was a federal employee under seven presidents, 27 years of service. He presented morning briefings to the White House presidents, the presidents in the White House. Welcome to our program, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, George.
What else can you elaborate on your career when you were a CIA officer? What else can you tell us about that 27 years?
Well, George, I was attracted to becoming a CIA analyst when I was in college. And it was the early days, early 60s, when I majored in Russian. It seemed to be kind of a lucky thing to have picked because, as you know, Sputnik went up and there were all kinds of very real, very genuine problems with the Soviet Union. So when I graduated and went for my master's degree, the Army said that I could start active duty. I had a two-year obligation as an Army infantry and intelligence officer. And they said that they would let me go through those two orientation periods down at Fort Benning and at Fort Hollenberg. And that I'd be stationed in Washington for a while. And CIA wanted me to be detailed there, and chances were that I could do that. So in April of 1963, when John Kennedy was president, I started working at the CIA and finished working many years later, 1990, after a very satisfying career, because what they told me the work would be like turned out to be true. Can you imagine?
Oh, man. Well, yeah, by today's standards, what the government tells us, it's hard to believe sometimes. But you were in a very stable period in there, weren't you?
Well, yeah. More to the point, George, most people don't really know enough about the CIA to be able to figure out what makes a person like me tick. When President Truman decided that he'd build a CIA and develop the legislation to justify it, it was under the impact of what had happened, of course, Pearl Harbor, when we had that surprise attack in 1941. Many people don't realize that there were little bits and pieces of information around among the code breakers and the Army intelligence folks and the people who monitored Japanese broadcasts and the Navy that found Japanese submarines in unaccustomed places. There was all manner of little bits and snippets of information which, if there were one central place where all those information bits came in, it would have been a no-brainer. You know, where is the Japanese fleet after all? How come we lost sight of it? And why is it that the Japanese ambassador is going out of Washington real quick?
Right.
So, you know, it was a kind of a no-brainer, and Truman knew that, and that's why he wanted a central intelligence agency. That means that there would be one agency that would be responsible only to him, okay, not to the State Department, not to the Pentagon, but directly under his aegis, a place where all the information on a given issue or a country would come into one inbox. And these days when I go talking to universities and colleges, I have to remind the students there that we had inboxes made out of wood, you know.
Right.
And they have trouble even visualizing that, but that's the way it was. So, just as I was promised, every day, about six or seven times a day, a fellow would come down pushing a, you know, look like a shopping cart, from our operations center, and into my inbox, he would pour all manner of information on my area of specialty, which was Soviet foreign policy, and specifically toward China and Indochina and the Far East. So I would get press, I would get intercepted messages, I would get clandestine reports from my own spies, I would get liaison reports, I would get satellite photography, I would get all manner of stuff. And it was my job to put it all together. And if there were a story to tell the president the next morning, wow, well, I would be responsible for drafting it. As long as my supervisors felt that I got it right, substantively, there was no interference. It was directly to the president. You know, if I misspelled a word or had a dangling participle, that would be fixed in the editorial process. But it was very, very heady business, George, very heady indeed, very responsible. And so under President Kennedy, right on through, that's the way it was. We were set up to tell it like it is. That's why Truman didn't want us under the Pentagon. Pentagon would tell him that, you know, the Soviets, they're 10 feet tall. Now, so, Truman knew they weren't 10 feet tall.
So there were enough. There was pretty good. There was pretty good separation back then when you were in the service in the CIA,
yeah.
Right? I mean, y'all respected those separations and so forth.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, the State Department would always have a policy to defend. So, in a word, what President Truman wanted was to have the ability to have a secretary call the head of the CIA. Out there in 7 miles away in Virginia on the other side of the Potomac, and say, for example, I want you down here at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Bring your three best specialists from among those three universities of specialists you have out there in the woods of Virginia. Bring the three very best on Vietnam, because the president has asked me to give him some advice at 6 o'clock in the White House, and I want to know what the best of your minds think. For example, there are these blue-suited types with a lot of stars on them, and they've told LBJ that we can bomb the heck out of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, seal it off, and the Ho Chi Minh will give up. And so I want to know what you guys think of that.
Right. Man, that's some heavy, heavy thinking, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, what we would do is get together and hash it all out. We knew a couple of things that not many other people knew, not only from our own spies, but from the people that literally brought Ho Chi Minh into Hanoi on their shoulders. I mean, when the Japs were driven out of Indochina, it was we and others who helped Ho Chi Minh get back into the country. Why? Because he was seen as a nationalist leader, and the Vietnamese were known to have thrown out the Chinese and the Japanese and other invaders in the past. So we knew a little bit about Ho Chi Minh. We also knew about the Ho Chi Minh Trail, right? And so, you know, this is kind of a digest of what actually happened. But so these fellows show up in the White House, and Truman says, okay, what do you think? And what we tell them is, now, President Truman, first of all, you have to realize we hope that the Ho Chi Minh Trail doesn't look anything like I-95 or I-81 or, you know, the parkways. It's like 181 little trails to the jungle. You can't even see most of it from the air. So if people are telling you that can be sealed off, well, we have to tell you that we don't think so. As a matter of fact, we know that's not true. Number two, even if you were able to seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail, We know Ho Chi Minh. He's not going to give up. As a matter of fact, Mr. President, nobody has ever given up just under bombing. It would take hundreds of thousands of troops to make Ho Chi Minh give up. And even then, we probably couldn't do it. Now, that's the kind of no-holds-barred, tell-it-like-it-is intelligence that Truman set up the CIA to perform and to advise him with. Now, there was an accident of history which has badly damaged the CIA, and it was present at the creation. Let me explain what I mean. After World War II, the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was composed of incredibly courageous, daring, imaginative people who did miracles in the European theater and the Far East as well, jumping behind enemy lines, the same ones that put Ho Chi Minh into Hanoi on their shoulders. They came back from the war, 1946-47, and, they got a lot of applause, and it was very well-deserved applause. And then they kind of asked around. They said, now, do you still need us? I mean, we're really good at overthrowing governments and jumping behind lines and stuff, but you want us to hang around, or should we go back to our law firms, our corporations, back to academia? What do you want? Well, the Russians, of course, had just overrun Eastern Europe. They were endangering the Balkans. Even France and Italy was in some question as to whether the communists would take over there. The KGB, the Soviet secret police, was running all over the world. What were they doing? Overthrowing governments and stuff like that. So the question answered itself. Do we need you? Of course we need you. Now, that's when somebody really dumb looked around for where they would put this bunch of overthrowers of government. We call it covert action. And somebody said, oh, hey, we're creating the Central Intelligence Agency, and they'll have to be secret because they'll be running their own spies to collect information so that they can advise the president. So since they'll be secret, let's put the operators in there. Let's put the people who overthrow governments in there, and we'll all be one happy family. A structural flaw from the outset. You can't have one director of Central Intelligence responsible for giving the president unvarnished intelligence and have him also in charge of running secret wars, as in Nicaragua, other wars, as in Vietnam, overthrowing governments, as in Chile. You can't have the same person responsible for both. So this, I call it a structural fault, was there from the beginning. And what they did in order to justify this juridically, they inserted one sentence in the National Security Act of 1947, which created not only the CIA, but the Defense Department, the Air Force, the National Security Council. It was a big deal, okay? The CIA was just part of it. But they inserted one sentence in the legislation that created CIA, and it reads as follows, quote, "The Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other services and duties from time to time as the President shall from time to time direct," period, end quote. Wow.
Wow.
What does that mean? Well, that means if you have an unscrupulous president and you have a director of Central Intelligence who thinks it's his job to serve the president and not the country, well, you get all kinds of abuses like torture, like kidnapping, like black prisons spread out around the world, like falsification of intelligence, like George Tenet, who was head of the CIA during George W. Bush's career, like what he did. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. After a five-year study, the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller was the head of it then, came up with its findings about pre-war intelligence on Iraq. And Jay Rockefeller, senator, who was in charge of that committee, said in introducing the results of this study, He said the pre-war intelligence to justify the war in Iraq was, quote, unsubstantiated, comma, contradicted, comma, or even non-existent, period, end quote. Now, Georgia, I ask you what non-existent intelligence might look like.
My gosh. I tell you, boy, sounds like a lie, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, that's down here in Texas, we tell a man straight out, you're lying to me.
Yeah, well, see, that's the difference. We don't, yeah. Here, we don't, you know, he liberties with the truth.
He's bending the truth, he's flexing the truth, or whatever,
prevaricator,
right? Prevaricator. Whoever invented that word.
Yeah, that's a 35-cent word. Anyhow, you know, non-existent intelligence, well, they meant the forgeries.
Right.
They meant the stuff that was manufactured out of whole cloth. See, George Tenet was unscrupulous. He said, the president wants to make a war, and it's our job to manufacture the intelligence to, quote, justify it, end quote. And not only that, because the president and von Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney wanted to give these prisoners the business, well, we could find people that would do that. It was a terrible chapter. Part of it's mostly over now. But my point here is simply, there are two CIAs, all right? I gave you a little bit of the history as
okay.
to how it evolved that there
okay.
were two. The one that I worked in for 27 years was, with certain small exceptions, faithful to the ethos of giving the president the straight scoop without fear or favor. And I'm proud to have worked in that atmosphere. We saved the government and the president from a lot of really, really dumb things by telling him the truth, embracing him with the truth, and warning him about blue-suited guys who thought they could do anything if they built airplanes big enough like the B-52. So that's kind of that I think will explain to your listeners why it is that I am who I am, why it is that I say what I say. And people will not think that I went through some special kind of knocked off my horse on the road to Damascus and all of a sudden got religion. No, I'm just being faithful to the ethos that we all grew up in on the analytical side of the house, which said, we speak the truth without fear or favor. People don't like that. And many a four-star general, I got their noses bent way out of joint because of what we said. And when they complained to the director of Central Intelligence, McGovern and his friends, they don't know what they're talking about, the director would stand up for us and say, no, we agree. We did get it right. Frankly, General, we think you got it wrong. Bottom line, I had career protection for telling them like it is. So, why do I say all that? I say all that so that people can understand that there are two CIAs. And, you know, I tell you, George, what often happens to me, I usually cram till the end before I go on making lectures at these universities. So I'm sitting in the back row there, and I'm getting my notes together. And a couple times this has happened, two students walk in, and one points to me and says, hey, that's him, you know? And then the other guy says, he don't look like a spy.
Man.
Now, I never know whether to be crestfallen about that or extremely disappointed or whether to be happy that people don't think I'm going around torturing people, you know? But
right.
there is this teaching point here. That there are two CIAs. I'm very proud of the work I did in the one. And, you know, even though the analysis part was also corrupted under George Tenet, what happened after that gives me hope for the future. You see, I was so distraught, and so were my colleagues, my veteran intelligence professionals for sanity colleagues. We were so upset that what happened to the analysis part of the agency that I, for example, was willing to throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know? the operations folks would always do what they were told, no matter how heinous. But the, that's an overstatement. They were also very good people in the operations department when I was there. They weren't torturing folks. But, you know, it was really hard to see our own profession, that is the profession of intelligence analysis, being corrupted to the point it was before the war in Iraq. So, just before I was willing to send the baby out there with the bathwater, all of a sudden something really good happens, George. Guess what?
What's that?
Somebody says, looks like Cheney and Bush have their sights set on Iran. Now, this time, we've got to do an honest estimate on Iran. We don't want it to be, over those words I used, unsubstantiated,
right. Contradicted,
or even non-existent intelligence, right? We want the real deal this time.
Right.
So they invited the head of State Department intelligence. His name was Tom Finger. And they invited him in, and they said, look, we need an estimate. The estimate is the supreme genre of analytic product. We need an estimate on weapons of mass destruction planning in Iran. And he said, no, I won't do that. And he said, wait a second, this is your shtick. You were the one that took all the footnotes on Iraq. Why won't you do it? He said, well, if you let me bring in some of my own experts from the State Department and from other agencies, then I'll do it. But I'm not going to do it with the same crowd that falsified the Iraqi estimate. And they said, okay. And that's what he did. And they worked from January until November of 2007. They threw out all the earlier estimates. They did a bottom-up approach. And guess what they found out? They announced in early November, first week of November 2007, that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and had not resumed work on that. So this is 4 years before 2007. That judgment has been reiterated and revalidated every year since, as recently as March of this year, 2013. Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the fall of 2003. Well, if I'm doing my arithmetic right, George, that means 10 years ago, and they have not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Now, that was a gutsy, gutsy judgment. It was unanimous. All 16 U.S. intelligence agencies agreed on that judgment. Now, what happened? Bush and Cheney were about to approve a war against Iran during their last year in office, 2008. The Israelis and Bush and Cheney had discussed all this. And in the end of October, Bush had said, Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. They're going to get it faster than anybody thinks. And it's a great danger. We have to stop that. And the journalist who was interviewing him said, well, what's your evidence for that? And Bush turned on him and he said, what do you want? World War III? Is that what you want? World War III? So that was the attitude right up until the estimate was released. And a summary of it was released in public. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. I don't suggest you buy the book, but Bush did write his own memoir. It's called Decision Points. Go to the library and look what he says about this. He says, this estimate took me by surprise. I don't know why they said those things. I mean, hello? I mean, could it be because it was true?
Yeah, 16 agencies coming together with the same conclusion. That's awful strong evidence.
It sure is, yeah. And, you know, he said that this estimate, and this is a quote, has deprived me of the military option. And another quote, same page, quote, for how could I authorize a military strike on the nuclear development facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program, end quote. Well, bummer.
Gosh.
I mean, if he was really afraid of the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon pretty soon, What would the appropriate reaction have been? I dare say it would have been, are you sure? Have you checked that out? Unanimous? Somebody tell the Israelis, good news, good news. Well, no.
Right,
no,
yeah.
And this is his own, you know, he must have written these pages himself. So it's very clear what was afoot. So what's my point? My point is that there's still very honest people in the Central Intelligence Agency and elsewhere in the government. And so, once again, I have reason to be proud that there are people there who look at the evidence and are unwilling to falsify it. Now, let's bring the situation up to Syria in the last couple of weeks. We know that there was a chemical event in the suburbs of Damascus. And when the president and the rest of the administration says this, they try to conflate two things. They say, no one doubts that there was a chemical event in the suburbs of Damascus on October 21st, and that that Bashar al-Assad, that Syrian president, was responsible. Well, not so fast, Mr. President. No one doubts that something really bad involving chemicals happened in those suburbs on the 21st of August, but there are a lot of people that want to see the evidence that the Syrian government, and specifically Bashar al-Assad, were responsible. The evidence is not there. What do we have? We have a four-page memo released by Kerry, who very much wanted to give the Syrians a bloody nose, released by Kerry. And is it an intelligence document? No. An intelligence document would have been issued by the National Intelligence Director, and that's the way it's always been in the past, and it would say intelligence assessment. This one says government assessment. And what does that mean? That means that the White House has had a chance to kind of tweak it, you know, to edit it, and make it seem a little bit more alarming, delete other things, and so it becomes no longer an intelligence estimate, and at least they have the common decency not to describe it as such, and they put it out as a government assessment. We assess this, we assess that, and we assess this with high confidence. But you know what? Right on that first page, there's a sentence. See if I can find it. I have it right here. Yeah, here it is. I'll read it to you. It's just very brief.
Sure.
Quote, our high confidence assessment is the strongest position that the U.S. intelligence community can take short of confirmation, end quote. Short of confirmation?
So, you mean, so they haven't confirmed anything, for sure.
You can have a high confidence assessment, but it's the best you can do short of confirmation. Well, before you make the new war, wouldn't you, normal people would want confirmation, no?
Yeah.
Here in the assessment itself, first page, they admit that. Now, being more particular, George, and this is a really important issue now, there are all kinds of reports that the U.S. government has intercepted communications indicating that the Syrian army was talking to Damascus, reporting to Assad that, it went well, the chemical attack took place as scheduled. And in other words, that the intercepted message shows that Assad was responsible for the chemical event on the 21st of August. There are other accounts of that message which say that the people speaking, the Syrian army officers, are shocked. They're surprised. They're saying, my God, what happened? Did somebody order a chemical attack here? We better tell Damascus right away because something really bad happened here, you know? Now, where's the truth, George? Where's the truth? Well, the truth is in the message, no doubt. And what I'm suggesting is that the president needs to release that message.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah. Now, you know, when you say those kinds of things, the intelligence people and the White House people who want to hide it. They say, oh, no, no, you can't do that. Oh, no, no, no. Because that involves intelligence sources and methods, and the Syrians would realize that we're eavesdropping on their conversations. Well, hello.
Yeah. Reading what their mail, shocker, man. Huh? They're reading their mail, man.
That would assume that the Syrians hadn't read any newspaper or seen any TV for the last 3 months when all these disclosures about our spying, eavesdropping, monitoring telephone calls of our own people. So that one does, that's, as LBJ would say.
They should have been sending carrier pigeons or something, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know. Been more secure than that, or couriers, you know.
You got it. So, LBJ would say, well, you know, that explanation is the dog that won't hunt, you know.
Yeah, dog that won't hunt. That's what old LBJ always said,
So what's the other explanation? Well, the other explanation is, you know, you're endangering sources and methods. Now, that's a legitimate concern. You know, I wasn't an intelligence officer in Army and the CIA for 30 years without appreciating the need to protect sources and methods. But there's precedent for Obama doing this. And let me explain there are several precedents, but the one that I lived through, which I think is the most analogous, is this. In 1986, there was a terrible terrorist bombing of a discotheque in Berlin, one that U.S. Army people used to frequent. Two U.S. Army troops were killed, several were wounded. All told, 230 people were badly wounded by that terrorist bomb. As soon as it went off, we knew who did it. We had intercepted conversations of the Libyans planning this attack, and then we finally got the smoking gun, a message that said, we carried it off with success at 1:30 this morning, and best of all, no one will ever find out about it.
Exactly.
Okay, so there's the intercepted message, okay? Now, what does Ronald Reagan do? He's really angry, right? This is the 5th of April, 1986, and Reagan comes to us and he says, are you sure about those intercepts? We said, we're not only able to intercept Libyan messages, but we can decode them, we can decrypt them. That's what went down. The Libyans did it. So what does Ronald Reagan do? Well, he gathers together under Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, 60 big aircraft, and they fly off from England, and they go around Gibraltar, and they bomb the hell out of Tripoli, including Gaddafi's palace, and Benghazi of recent memory.
Right.
They hit it all really bad, okay? Now, what happens? They miss Gaddafi, but they did get his 15-month-old little daughter.
Yeah, he was in a tent outside his home.
Right.
I think that's why they missed him,
Killed the little girl. They severely wounded his youngest son, who was three years at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not good PR, you know?
No, it's not.
Yeah. So the rest of the world, George, was in high dudgeon. They were really, really angry. And, of course, everyone knew that Omar Gaddafi was not Ronald Reagan's favorite person. And so there was 90% certainty in the world outside that here was Reagan shooting from the hip, making believe he had evidence that Libya was responsible for that bombing in Berlin and just been killing little kids. And, you know, there were other civilians killed. It just looked really bad. So what does Reagan do? Reagan comes to us, and he says, let me see that intercepted message again. So we showed it to him. He says, we have to release this. Now, of course, we said, oh, he can't do that. No, he can't do that. We don't think the Libyans know that we can decipher.
Right.
So you would be sacrificing a really good source. And Reagan, to his great credit, said, release it. Do it. And do it today. And we did it. And the world saw that Reagan was not shooting from the hip. The world saw that the Libyans not only perpetrated this, but were so smug that in that message I mentioned said, and no one will ever find out about it.
Right.
Well, we did. Now, there's no reason at all why Obama can't do the same thing. And the fact that he doesn't do the same thing with this message that's very much disputed suggests to a lot of us that the government case is not as conclusive as everyone suggests. In other words, this message either proves the government's case or not. And if it does, I mean, we know the substance of the message. It's been in the press. We know the Syrians, unless they're really dumb, are aware that we eavesdropped on everybody and his brother and his sister. And so there's no reason not to release this message unless it doesn't say what the White House has been claiming it said. And I suspect that's the reason. So we intelligence professionals, even though we're retired, we want to educate the American people to the fact that somebody's messing around with the intelligence again. And, you know, who might that be? Well, these people are, you know, to quote Mark Antony, these people are honorable men, right?
Yeah, sure.
James Clymer is an honorable man, even though he lied under oath before Congress, even though he apologized by saying, well, what I said was clearly erroneous, and even though even Andrea Mitchell couldn't get him off the hook when she asked him, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, I decided to say, quote, the least untruthful thing, end quote. Give me a break.
The least untruthful thing, my gosh.
Yeah, that's nice. But he should be in jail. He shouldn't be head of the... He's still there, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, his credibility is not what it should be. And John Brennan, the head of the CIA, well, I know that guy. I work with him.
Right.
I asked him to walk my dog. I mean, he's the guy who claimed 2 years ago that for almost the entire previous year, not one civilian had been killed in all those drone strikes in Pakistan.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And the press laughed him out of the room, but that's what he said. So he lies a lot. So does Clapper. And so small wonder that the president may not know the real story. See, there's a procedure that is known in Washington as plausible denial, okay? That's a kind of a state-of-the-art term from tradecraft. And what it does is this. Let's say John Kennedy wants Castro to be meeting his maker real soon, and the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, knows that, and he doesn't go to John Kennedy and say, we're sending Joe Schmo to poison Castro's cigars. Now, he doesn't say that, because then if the president was asked, did you know about this? He would have to say, if you were honest, oh, yeah, I knew about that. We assassinate people now.
Man.
You don't tell him, then he has what they call plausible denial. You don't tell the president. You're pretty sure you know what he wants. And in this case, in the Syrian case, it looked like Brennan, Clapper, and the other people, they certainly knew what John Kerry wanted. And they probably figured, well, Obama wants this too. So it could well be that in order to give Obama plausible denial, they didn't tell him the whole truth. And he's just as much in the dark about what this message says as we are. That's possible. That sounds really strange, but that's the way these guys operate.
Right.
So Obama knows the 100% truth or not? I don't know. But if he doesn't, and if he hasn't had the guts by now to ask to read that intercepted message, well, I've been saying for many years, George, that Obama needs a backbone implant, okay?
Yes, uh-huh.
And I've checked with the doctors at George Washington University Hospital here in Washington, And they tell me they're 5 years away from perfecting that procedure.
So right, right.
We're out of luck.
You know, he waffles a lot, and he gives in to the biggest pressures that are on him, it seems like. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that's my diagnosis.
He changes his mind. He waffles from one, you know, conclusion or decision to another, and he sort of just, you know, he's not... You know, you can't count on his thinking. It's always changing.
That's right, you know, and it could be even worse, George. And I can't believe I'm hearing myself say this, but I think he's afraid. I think he's afraid of the CIA. I think he's afraid of the other parts of our military and the other national security organizations of our government. Number one, because he doesn't know how they work. And number two, because he knows a little bit of history. He knows that John Kennedy was done in by a plot led by the ex-CIA director, Alan Dulles, whom Kennedy canned after the Bay of Pigs.
Yes, right.
He knows that Alan Dulles insinuated himself onto the Warren Commission and became its executive director, letting...
Right.
Certain people testify and others not. There's a great book on this. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas. Two S's and the Douglas. I suggest that to your listeners. It'll show you how intricate the plot was, but not only the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA and other organs of the government, to include parts of the Secret Service and the FBI, why they thought John Kennedy was going soft on communism and needed to be eliminated. What I'm saying here is that I'm sure that Barack Obama's read that book.
Right.
I'm also sure that he knows, and this is fact, that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed by a government conspiracy. And the last thing I'll say on this is something that came to me just 2 years ago, and that is this. 3 years ago, when Barack Obama's progressive friends, who happened to be also very wealthy and major contributors to his campaign, they had a little dinner with him. And there were only about 12 people there or so. And they were pretty much beating on him. You had progressive credentials. Why is it that you have now established a national security state? Why is it that you want people to spy on one another, and why are you so hard on whistleblowers, and the whole nine yards? And so why don't you step up to, you know, who we thought you were? And you know what he says? He got a little ticked off. He turned on him and he said, "So you don't remember what happened to Martin Luther King?"
Man. God.
Now, I have that from a very good source, okay?
Yeah.
If that's the attitude of the President of the United States, and he's afraid to appear as John Kennedy did, too liberal or too much seeking peace or seeking accommodations with, quote, known enemies like the Syrians, well, he feels circumscribed. The backbone implant's not going to be done within 5 years. And so what is it going to take? It's going to take us. You know,
right.
My favorite theologian, Annie Dillard, says, there only is us. There never has been anybody else. And this time around, and that's the real lesson of what happened during these last 2 weeks, the American people made it very clear that they didn't want another war. They told all their senators, they told all their representatives, and so as soon as Barack Obama, and this was a good thing, turned it over to Congress and said, "I need congressional authorization." So the people spoke. And over that week, and it was just last week, it seems like 100 years ago, not only was the campaign to drum up support for an attack on Syria, but not only was it unsuccessful, but it was counterproductive. And who said that? Well, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Rogers, who's a real... you know, who really wanted the attack, the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, McKeon, and said that, you know, you haven't proved to me that Assad was responsible for these chemical attacks. And so what ended up happening was the American people made it so difficult for the president to go ahead with this attack, not to mention the international community, where the British even voted against it, that all of a sudden Obama was thrown a lifeline. And it's highly ironic that that lifeline came from Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. You know, I'm a specialist on Russia. My graduate degree is in Russian history. I never thought, never ever imagined that there would be a point in history where the Russian president would bail out the U.S. president and help him to avoid starting another counterproductive war. So that's what happened. And now we need to keep the pressure on, because there are lots of people that are heavily disappointed that there's no war. Who do I think these people are? Well, I know who they are. They're the people that kind of egged on Obama to begin with. The only country that profits from what's going on in Syria right now is Israel. Let's just say it right out. I can say it because I'm not running for any office and I don't need any extra money. The only country that sees the tumults, sees the chaos in Syria as a good thing, are the Israelis. Why? Well, because as long as they can keep the Sunni and the Shia at each other's throats, and mind you, not only in Syria, but also in the wider area, Iraq and Lebanon, all the surrounding countries, Jordan, the longer they're at each other's throats and start killing each other off, the least likely they are to hit off against Israel. And so, actually, there's a very interesting article in the New York Times on Friday, August the 30th, where its Jerusalem correspondent said and reported that, yeah, I talked to all manner of senior Israeli officials, and I asked them, you know, what do you see as the best outcome of all this trouble in Syria? And the answer is, no outcome. And she said, what do you mean, no outcome? Well, the best outcome for us Israelis is that this pot keeps boiling. You've heard of the 30 years war in Europe? Well, yeah, it wouldn't be so bad. Why? Because what I said, when these things are happening and they're not any threat to Israel and their declared enemies or their putative enemies are killing each other off, well, why should we stop it? Now, there's a wrinkle here, because the government of Assad started winning about 2 months ago. Now, that's dangerous, because Assad, if he wins, well, then he'll be more powerful and could maybe pose more of a danger for Israel. But the other guys, you know, they're equally bad. Al-Qaeda is there, al-Nusra, these are really bad actors. So it's not that the Israelis want one or the other side to win, but if the government is winning, if Assad is winning, well, something needs to be done. And what needed to be done, of course, was to have people intervene and have the U.S. get embroiled in this thing. Because once the U.S. is involved militarily, well, you know, Al-Qaeda is not going to win. Al-Nusra is not going to win. And in the end analysis, Bashar al-Assad is not going to win either. So get the U.S. involved. So what do I think about this incident and on August 21st? I don't know. But there's a likely possibility that the Israelis played a role in that. Why? Because they want the U.S. in with both feet. And why would that happen? Well, because our president made a stupid mistake a year ago saying there's a red line. I guess he learned red lines from Prime Minister Netanyahu, who favors
right.
Red. Yeah, so Barack Obama said there's a red line, and that's chemical weapons if they're used, you know. So here's the scenario. Mid-August, UN inspectors arrive in Syria, allowed in Syria by Assad. They're going to investigate previous chemical events. 2 days later, this chemical event or attack or whatever it was on the 21st of August. Now, logic has to be stretched to think that Assad would see any benefit in perpetrating a chemical event with the UN inspectors already in his country.
Right,
you know?
That would be insanity, yeah. Right.
But the other side might have incentive, you know. They might say, well, if we can pin this on the government, and if we can, you know, get the Israelis to manufacture an intercepted message, then we'll put Barack Obama really on the spot. And you've heard all this stuff about, well, what would ever happen to the U.S. if the president's word wasn't kept and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's what went on here. And it was thoroughly ironic and really, really a roller coaster kind of thing when, in the end, on the 30th of August, looked like we were surely going to hit Syria with an attack. John Kerry describes it as a unbelievably limited attack.
Yeah, unbelievably limited. What is it? This is so crazy. Some of these assertions are just mad. You know?
Yeah, that's it. You know, see, I have my prejudices. I'm an Army infantry officer. Okay, that's why I don't like these blue-suited generals that thought we could bomb our way out of Vietnam.
Sure.
And that's why I don't like sailors that sail up the Mekong, you know, and think they know something about war strategy. I also don't like young people wet behind their ears in the White House. Young tough guys and tough gals now, okay, who think they know more than the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff about war. Now, that's a very precarious situation. Obama should not be listening to these folks. So what he needs to do now is face up to his obligation to be straight with the American people. If he's been lied to, he needs to let that hang out. He's got to say, well, you know, these people maybe meant well, trying to give me plausible denial, but they didn't tell me that the message says, oh, we're surprised as hell. What's going on here? Who authorized this attack? They didn't tell me that. They told me a different version of it. So that's going to be the key now, and we have to make sure that the American people continue to support the initiative that Russia and Syria now has agreed to destroy the chemical weapons in Syria. Now, people say, Kerry said they had to destroy it this week.
Yeah, this week. Well, what pitfalls do you see in establishing some kind of extraction of those chemical weapons or eliminating those? Is it possible, or what could blow up in the midstream?
George, actually, you used that figuratively, but things can also literally blow up in these kinds of exercises.
Right.
You ask a really good question. The answer is it's terribly complicated.
Yes.
It's technologically challenging, but it can be done. You know, when the Soviet Union imploded, there was all kinds of nuclear material buried under mountains out in places like Semipalatinsk in Central Asia or in Siberia. And some of the Russians didn't even remember where they had stored this stuff. But over a period of years, now we're going back 20 years, aren't we, the Americans and other internationals and the Russians got together and they figured out how to find it and how to destroy it. Now, if they can do that with nuclear material, they can certainly do it with chemical weapons, and that has been done in other countries. We're doing it ourselves. We're missing deadlines, according to the treaty, but we've found ways to chemically eliminate chemical weapons. So it can be done. Will it be hard? Yes, it will be hard. Will it require a certain modicum of peace? Yes, it will. And that's where the rebels, whoever they are, whoever they have allegiance to, that's where they could cause real trouble. But we dodged a bullet here, George. You know, we gave peace a chance.
Right.
And being morose about it, as I was watching CNN, it was like they were a funeral, you know. We're not going to have a war after all. They were angry and disappointed. I did an interview on CNN on Monday night. Monday was the day that all this went down.
Right.
And So I was on CNN International, and I was watching Anderson Cooper, for example, and he's got something far from fair and balanced. He's got Ari Fleischer, who is the press spokesman for George W. Bush. He's got David Gergen, who pretends to be a relatively independent Republican. But they were angry. They would say, how could Putin do these kinds of things? And what does that mean for holding Assad accountable? And it was just, you know, the whole attitude, the tone was morose. A funereal is a good adjective for it. War had been done a wicked blow here. People were making peace, and the guys interviewed on CNN didn't like that.
Oh, I tell you. God, crazy, isn't it? Huh?
It is.
There's a balkanizing of those Arab nations that seems to reflect the Bernard Lewis plan. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I am. And, you know, part of this is due to our intervention and the intervention of other Western states. You know, the Arab states were balkanized by design.
Right.
By France and others to make sure that we could divide and conquer. That's not going to last forever. And, you know, it's going to be decades more. But I think we turned a corner on this one. I think the American people are sick and tired of war, and I think they've found a way to make their voices heard. And when people like Carl Levin, now, Carl Levin is one of the most powerful people in the Senate. He's head of the Senate Armed Services Committee. What did he say today? He said, I'm worried that the American resistance to another war will prevent a vote authorizing the president to make war on Syria, because we have to demonstrate strength here, and this would be really bad. Now, who is Carl Levin? Well, he's one of these neoconservatives who finds great difficulty distinguishing between the national security interests of Israel on the one hand and the national security interests of the United States on the other. Now, I don't fault them for that. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But his job is to pursue the national security interests of the United States exclusively. And he shouldn't be overshadowed by this other loyalty. So who is he? Well, he's been in the Senate a long time. The Israel lobby, AIPAC, has funded a lot of these people. George, guess who is the senator who has received more funding from the Israel lobby than all other senators and all other representatives in Congress?
Who's that?
All 11.
Really? Okay, yeah. I got you. Yeah.
So, you know, money speaks.
Yeah.
And if you look at the defense contractors and who they support, those senators and representatives are susceptible to pressures from them as well, because they give them money too. So, the people spoke this time, and I'm really, really enthusiastic, and I've been trying to persuade my skeptical friends, you know.
Right.
They can't take yes for an answer, you know. They can't
see
the rare times when we should be rejoicing. And so
we
say rejoice, and again, I say rejoice, as the old
right.
Thing said.
We've got a minute before we need to close out. Is there any closing comments you'd like to make in this last minute?
Well, I just would say one more time that I haven't seen this kind of public pressure on the part of the American people as a body politic since we closed down the Vietnam War. That's a long time, George.
Right.
We're talking 1972, 73. And so we can't let up. We have to make it clear to Obama and everyone else, and particularly our representatives in Congress, no more war, especially war that cannot be justified by the facts. The other thing is, we should insist that the president make available the evidence that his cronies contend indicate that Assad was personally personally responsible for that chemical event. Those two things I would suggest, and I thank you very much for having me on.
Okay, well, Ray McGovern, thank you very much. You can find more of his articles at raymcgovern.com. Thank you.
You're most welcome, George.
Okay, thank you. Good night.